Seated, please. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We have four argued cases this morning. The first case before us is Rasmussen v. United States, docket number 145089. Mr. Littleton, it's my understanding that you want to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Matt Littleton, representing the United States. May it please the Court, in this appeal, we ask this Court to uphold the fundamental legal principle that landowners in takings cases must be placed in the exact same financial position they would have occupied had the takings not occurred. Had the takings not occurred here, Union Pacific Railroad Company's legal easement rights would have reverted to plaintiffs, but neither Union Pacific nor the federal government would have been obligated to demolish the abandoned rail line or restore it to the condition of the surrounding farmland.
There's no disagreement on that proposition, is there?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
I don't think so either.
That was not part of the bargain that plaintiffs' predecessors in interest struck in the 19th century when they granted easement rights to the railroad. However, the Court of Federal Claims in this case valued the property in question as though Union Pacific or the federal government would have done that, leaving the plaintiffs with vacant farmland. And that was legal error. It was not harmless because all of the witnesses at trial, including all of plaintiffs' witnesses, acknowledged that it would have an impact on the value of property, the value of farmland property, if there was an abandoned rail line running through it.
Whether they testified it would have an impact or whether they would consider whether it had an impact.
So there was a testimony from...
Nitpicking, but I thought the testimony was that any reasonable buyer would look at the condition of the property before they pulled out their checkbook.
Well, that was certainly the testimony on all counts. Plaintiff's experts, however, went further. For example, Mr. Hodge, plaintiff's auxiliary expert, said that in fact it would lower the fair market value. Now, we can argue about how much, but that's something that the trial court didn't
engage. Well, it may end up in being, in essence, like a peppercorn here. You're arguing for the principle, for the money.
We're arguing for the principle, and it's something that the trial court must consider.
There was, in fact, testimony that it wouldn't actually cost very much, right?
There was testimony from... So plaintiff's appraiser didn't engage in this issue at all. He said that because of instructions from plaintiff's counsel, he didn't address the question.
What was the nature of that instruction of the counsel? I couldn't find anything in the record.
So
was that on the record what the counsel said to the witness?
No, Your Honor. It was unclear at trial exactly what they'd been instructed. It should have appeared in plaintiff's appraiser's report. However, it was not reported there. All that we know is on page 7721, A7721, you see plaintiff's appraiser's report, which says, contrary to fact, this report presumes that the physical remnants of the railway would not have a negative impact. So that alone suggests that there would be an actual reduction in fair market value because of the presence of these remnants. However, plaintiff's appraiser testified that he did not consider it because he was instructed in a way that he was not to.
Is this really a legal issue? I mean, you argue that it's a legal issue we should review de novo, but couldn't you characterize what the Court of Federal Claims did as simply accept the testimony of the landowner's appraiser as what would be an appropriate approach by an appraiser in this case?
First of all, so there are two parts to that question. Your Honor, we think it is a legal issue because it goes to the nature of an easement. An easement is an intangible legal interest that does not obligate the easement holder to restore pre-easement conditions upon abandonment. So that's really a legal question. On the testimony issue, the testimony cited by the trial court was mostly from Mr. Stille, who was a plaintiff farmer who testified only on rebuttal. He was a lay witness, testified as to whether and how he would have reclaimed the property. But he also testified that there would be reclamation costs. He hadn't calculated how much they would be, and he only testified with respect to his own property as opposed to all of the various properties.
Wasn't there testimony that
in
previous takings cases the government hasn't objected to the methodology that was used here?
There was testimony from the plaintiff's auxiliary experts on that point. However, as the trial court noted at page A24, note 21, the government objected to that testimony in prior cases. And in any event, it's irrelevant because all of those cases were settled.
Is this an outlier case? I mean, why hasn't this come up before?
Your Honor,
just from perspective of your brief, it's just a no-brainer. I mean, you see this as one of the simplest cases you've ever had to argue up here. And so I wonder, why on earth hasn't this come up before?
In most cases, Your Honor, once liability is established, just compensation is settled because it's just a dollar value. And that's what happened in most of the cases, all of the cases that plaintiff's appraisers brought up that they're talking about. That's why they can't offer any citation.
Right, but all these, I mean, the court is familiar with the rails to trails problems going all the way back to Preso, as you know.
Right.
And there have been a lot of them, and the value of these right-of-ways obviously varies tremendously from place to place, and the condition of the right-of-way varies considerably from place to place. So you would have thought that there might even have been up around Love Canal a right-of-way that where the toxic chemicals were all over the bed, rail bed.
Well, Your Honor, I don't want to speculate on any particular case, but I'd say again that most of these cases are settled, and our view is that this is such a straightforward fundamental principle that it hasn't been contested in other cases. The only reason it came up here...
Even in the supplemental authority that you propose, there are quotes in there from the first OD case saying, you know, it's because of the nature of this type of dispute between the government and the landowner, the normal appraisal principles don't fit exactly. Isn't that right?
Right. I mean, what the plaintiff's appraiser did was, in addition to receiving the instruction from counsel, he said, well, ordinarily you don't consider a previous right-of-way. Well, that's because ordinarily there's nothing there. You're talking about a new road, a new imposition of a new easement. Whereas here, there's nothing specifically unique about rails to trails, but one unusual feature is that you're talking about a new easement allegedly being imposed, superimposed over an old easement. So that's why you have to consider the fact that the conditions created by that old easement remain in the event of abandonment. So getting back to Judge Clevenger's question, I think the fundamental point is that the legal principle holds regardless of whether it's come up in previous cases, and we ask this court to simply affirm that principle here.
Isn't it a classic case of the fact that these landowners, they didn't necessarily voluntarily give up these easements in the first instance? I mean, they because of the government's desire to have a railway system, these landowners were stuck with one easement, now they're going to get stuck with another one, and you're saying they should pay for the first one?
Well, plaintiff's predecessors in interest were fully compensated for the initial easement, whether in through easement deeds or formal condemnation proceedings. And the terms of those deeds did not provide that upon abandonment, the railroad would get rid of the rail line entirely. And so plaintiffs acquired their property subject to those easements, and they can't effectively amend them now to get compensation for something that they've effectively already been compensated
and
for.
And how much money do you think at issue here?
Your Honor, our appraiser argued that it was in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. Plaintiff's appraiser, you know, if on remand...
Well, and your appraiser's methodology was heavily criticized by the district, by the trial judge.
It was, and the trial judge said that our appraiser overstated the cost. However, that's not to say that the costs don't exist. So how much it will turn out to be on remand is something for the court to consider once it has evidence from the plaintiffs. But the plaintiffs failed to carry their burden to actually present any evidence on this question. If it were our burden in the first instance to provide evidence of how much of what the fair market value of the property was,
would be harmless error.
Right, but it's not our burden. It's the plaintiff's burden. And instead of presenting affirmative evidence, they just criticized our evidence and said it was too much. And that's not enough. So unless the court has further questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Okay.
May it please the Court, Your Honor. My name is Tom Stewart, on behalf of the plaintiffs, appellees in this case, and on behalf of all of the Iowa farmers in all three of these consolidated cases, we firmly believe that Judge Firestone's opinion should be summarily affirmed. This is a very simple issue on appeal because the government does not contest liability, and they've chosen to appeal what is really a non-issue under appraisal standards and methodology and the law, which is also an inconsequential issue relating to damages.
How do you know it's inconsequential if your appraiser never did an analysis of it?
Well, for example, Your Honor, if you turn to page 7 of the government's brief to put this issue in perspective, they have tried to argue that the difference between the appraisers in this case is $1,600,000 and $600,000 on the agricultural parcels, and they've tried to say that this issue will repeat itself in other rails-to-trails cases. But the purported difference between $1,600,000 and $600,000 was really the result of two issues that were hotly contested at trial, one of which was this cost-to-reclaim issue, which was very minor and inconsequential. The second one was with respect to severance damages for bisected or separated agricultural parcels.
On your inconsequential point, let's just assume that all that was at stake was $100. Why isn't that sufficient for having a case or controversy?
Well, because the government is also wrong legally, Your Honor, with respect to the standard.
Are you going to give up the inconsequential point? I mean,
I just wanted to make the point, Your Honor. I'm not giving it up.
Not a lot is at stake here. I appreciate that.
Okay, and I just wanted to make the point that Judge Firestone, on page 200 of the transcript, identified with that issue and said she was not overwhelmed with this entire discussion.
So it may be that the government is holding, has decided to take these particular landowners and to push the point so that it doesn't have to make this argument every single time. So it may be only $100 to you, but it could be 100 times whatever to the government, right?
I understand that, Your Honor, but since they're also wrong legally with respect to the standard for determination of the highest and best use, I don't want to give up this issue of inconsequential because actually the cost associated with the cost to reclaim is a factor that appraisers do consider and should consider with respect to the determination of highest and best use. And the testimony.
But your appraiser didn't do that here, did he?
Yes. In fact, our appraiser, Mr. Hodge, testified specifically
that he took into account the reclamation costs.
Yes, and that they were inconsequential. And in fact, if you look at Judge Fires,
do you think the government's wrong when it says your expert testified that he was instructed to exclude them?
Our appraisers were not instructed, Your Honor, to exclude or not to consider the cost of reclamation. They were instructed to appraise the property as if it was unencumbered in the before condition, which is exactly what this court
has
said.
Isn't that the same thing? What do you mean by unencumbered in the before condition?
Unencumbered in the before condition means that the as if the easement was not in place at the time of the taking.
And what easement are you talking about here?
Easement is the original railroad purposes easement on this farmer's land.
Right. So how would he not consider that, but still be considering the cost of removing the items that were part of the easement?
I think the answer, Your Honor, is in the appraisal standards themselves, in the Yellow Book, there is a three-part test that has been developed over decades, and this decision by the appraisers is the most important in the appraisal process to determine the highest and best use. And the three-part test is that it first has to be, the use has to be physically possible. The second test is it has to be legally permissible.
I'm confused why you're talking about the expired railroad easement in the first place. Your landowners have already been compensated for that. Aren't we talking about the new rails-to-trails easement?
Well, yes, Your Honor.
When we do that, don't we compare what the property value is absent the easement and it with the easement?
Yes.
Why is the expired easement relevant to this at all?
Well, they have to be paid, Your Honor, for the taking of their reversionary interest, which is their reversionary interest in that railroad purposes easement. It has been supplanted with a hiking...
The reversionary interest is what? The land would have reverted to them when the easement expired in the condition that the railroads left it, right?
Yes.
And so isn't that what we're comparing? The condition the railroads left it in with the value of it encumbered by the government's new easement.
Yes, but it's the under the appraisal standards, the determination of highest and best use is that land is to be assumed that it is the same as agricultural land before and after, In other words, it's not appraised as a hiking and biking trail easement. It's not appraised as a railroad purposes easement. It's appraised as if it's agricultural land, which is vacant and ready for use as agricultural land.
Is that because agricultural use surrounds the easement property?
Yes, Your Honor. It's part of the larger parcel. In other words, the appraisal...
How is that possible? If the government had taken land in the middle of a farm for a chemical factory and had decided to give it back as is and then decided to put some kind of a new easement on it, you wouldn't assume that that land was pristine farmland. You would assume it was in the condition of the land after the chemical factory had been vacated, right?
No, you would, under that scenario, you would appraise that land as if it was agricultural land.
So you're putting your client in a better position than it would have been if the government hadn't taken a new easement, aren't you?
No, I believe we're putting the...
How is that not possible? If the farmers had this land reverted to them from the railroad company,
right,
they would have to make the reclamation cost themselves, right?
Unlikely, Your Honor. I don't believe they're responsible for the reclamation costs.
And isn't that what Iowa law says? Basically, that the railroad has the right to remove the remnants within 1 year if it wants to, but it's completely discretionary with the railroad. So if it leaves the remnants, then the landowner has to deal with those remnants if it wants to use the land for some other purpose.
And under the appraisal methodology, Your Honor, well, first of all, if you look at the rails and ties, they obviously have substantial value.
But that goes to the valuation, not the legal method.
Yeah. I mean, wouldn't you could balance the cost of removal with the cost of whatever that would those the rails and the ties would be, right? Isn't that what an appraiser would do?
Well, the appraiser is instructed to follow the Yellow Book, which is the uniform standards of for federal land acquisitions. And the Yellow Book instructs them to do a before and after appraisal. The before appraisal is as if the land was part of the larger parcel and was vacant and available for such use as part of the larger parcel. And in this case, since the highest and best...
That's your problem. It wasn't available for use like the larger parcel until the reclamation was done.
That's what the appraisers are instructed to assume under the Yellow Book.
Well, what if we conclude that's legal error?
Well, if that's legal error, then the appraisal standards themselves would not be followed.
I think your reading of that Yellow Book might be legal error. You're suggesting that the land is in a condition different than it actually is.
And I believe
it's fiction.
I believe that's...
Let me ask you a hypothetical. Suppose the land value would cost you $1 million to reclaim as farmland, but the government came in and took a new rails-to-trails easement. Do you say we don't consider that $1 million reclamation cost at all?
I don't believe so under the Yellow Book, Your Honor.
But the Yellow Book says the appraiser shall estimate the value of the land for its highest and best use, but must consider physical characteristics of the land and must bear in mind that the property must be valued in its as-is condition. I mean, I don't think the Yellow Book is as formulaic as you're making it out to be.
Well, I believe that falls under the judgment of the appraisers in all of these rails-to-trails cases. But what that really says is they have to utilize or consider the physical attributes of the land to determine what the highest and best use of the land is under the financially feasible test. Under Judge Hughes's question, if it's not financially feasible...
How would you take the hypothetical Judge Hughes has been giving you, one where during the life of the easement before the rails to trails, there were toxic chemicals or something put on the ground that would obviously impair agricultural use? So how does the existence of those toxic chemicals key into highest and best use? The easement goes right through agricultural property. No towns anywhere near, no possibility of high rises or anything else. Only possible use is agrarian, right?
Right.
So now I have an easement through agrarian property that the highest and best use is going to be agrarian, but it's poisoned with toxic chemicals. It would be against the law to farm it in its current condition.
The Yellow Book instructs...
What do you do then?
The Yellow Book instructs in that situation, if it's not financially feasible to treat that highest and best use as agricultural land, they can't treat that as highest and best use as agricultural land. Same thing applies...
What is the highest
and hypothetical. What would be the highest and best use of this polluted easement?
It would basically be contaminated and worthless land. under the Yellow Book standards. And so in this situation, if it's $1 million to reclaim farmland and it's not financially feasible to reclaim that farmland, then the highest and best use of that is not agricultural land. And it can't be treated as agricultural.
But it is financially feasible to reclaim. The burden of making it financially feasible falls on the government, not on the landowner.
Well, I'm not sure.
Well, isn't that where your case is?
That's what Iowa law says with respect to the railroads being able to salvage the rails and ties. Under the Yellow Book standard, if the farmer can reclaim that land and it's an inconsequential cost, as plaintiff's experts testified to.
Well, if it's inconsequential cost, on remand you can argue that, but you didn't start from that position that it was an inconsequential cost. You started from the position that we can't consider that cost at all.
No, I didn't. I apologize, Ron. I don't believe we started from that position at all. We have said from the very beginning that there has to be a financially feasible test under the Yellow Book to determine what the highest and best use
of
the property is.
If it's financially feasible to reclaim the land for farm use, but it costs X amount of dollars to do that, you think the government should bear the X amount of dollars, not your clients?
I don't believe there is any cost to assess against either party.
Well, you're not answering the question, though, because the government thinks there is a cost here. If you think there's zero cost, then on remand you're going to win. But let's assume there's a cost. Who bears it?
I believe under that circumstance, if it goes a year and nobody reclaims it in Iowa, then the farmers would have to reclaim their land at their cost. I believe under the Yellow Book, that is inconsequential.
So you're saying the Yellow Book somehow, because of the way you walk through the process, you ignore a true fair market value analysis?
No, I believe it is a true fair market value analysis, Your Honor, because the government is really trying to blur the concept of fair market value and highest and best use. You have to establish the fair market value based on the highest and best use. Under the Olson case by the Supreme Court in 1934, and under the County Board of County Supervisors case that this court decided in 2002, the test is whether the land is adaptable, which is the physically possible test, and whether it is easily converted, which is the financially feasible test. And if it is easily converted under the financially feasible test, that becomes the highest and best use of the land, and it then therefore has to be appraised as if it is vacant and ready for such use.
Well, and that's the latter stage. That's where the rub is. I don't think the government necessarily disagrees with you in that series of sentences up to the very last one.
The very last one being
that it has to be appraised. You're going to look at it as if there's never been any impairment to the property. You've decided that whatever impairment of the property wasn't sufficient to stop it from having a highest and best use of X. And then the next step is, okay, now you look at the property as though it had never been impaired.
And I believe that's exactly what the Yellow Book requires, Your Honor. Under Section A15 of the Yellow Book, it specifically says that once it is determined that it's financially feasible and it becomes the highest and best use of the property, it is then to be appraised as if it is vacant and ready for such use. There is nothing in the Yellow Book anywhere that authorizes or allows the government to charge these landowners for the physical remnants or to deduct the purported cost to reclaim. There is no authority whatsoever for that provision. And so I believe it is absolutely correct.
Well, the government says the authority to the contrary is the Constitution.
Well, I believe that just compensation requires, under the Fifth Amendment, that they be paid the fair market value of their land. And the fair market...
So, in your judgment, this case boils down to a constitutional law case.
It's always a constitutional law case under the just compensation provisions.
Well, why shouldn't the government prevail under the Constitution? Say, I'm sorry, your reading of the Yellow Book is unconstitutional.
Because I believe our reading of the Yellow Book is absolutely correct as it's been applied in all of these cases.
If it puts on the government the burden of the cost of making the property available for its highest and best use?
Because I believe the standards under the Yellow Book require that.
Yeah, but you're being circular. What I'm asking you is whether or not the provision 8.15 is constitutional.
I believe 8.15 is constitutional, and I believe these...
Because you believe that the cost of making the property usable for its highest and best use should be taxed to the government in these circumstances.
I believe there's
not
no...
Not to the landowner.
I apologize, I'm over my time, Your Honor, but I believe it's no different for commercial, industrial, or residential parcels either, which these same remnants were present for those parcels, just like they were present for the agricultural parcels as well. I'm sorry, exceeded my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
You both spent a lot of time discussing the Yellow Book in your briefs. So what's your position with respect to the Yellow Book? Do you agree that the Yellow Book would support the landowner's position here?
No, Your Honor. Okay. And well, first of all, as Judge Clevenger was alluding to at the end of counsel's argument, it's ultimately irrelevant what the Yellow Book says because this is a question of law. Just compensation is a question of constitutional law, not appraisal methodology. And that fundamentally is why this is a legal and not a factual question. But second, in terms of the Yellow Book clearly states that hypothetical conditions such as the one plaintiffs adopted is only appropriate if it is legally required. It was not legally required here to assume for purposes of valuation that the abandoned rail line was actually not there. And to getting to your point,
When would it be legally required to assume a hypothetical condition?
I don't want to speculate, but it's quite rare, one would think, because you're valuing the before and after. And what's valued for the plaintiffs is the property they would have had the taking not occurred. And the plaintiffs' counsel has not argued that the railroad, even if it took up the ties and the tracks, what you're talking about is, and as illustrated on page 20 of our opening brief, the photo of Mr. Stille's property, this is a huge amount of land. And so even if the railroad had decided that it was worthwhile to come back and take the ties and tracks off, why on earth would it have gone through with a bulldozer and eliminated all of those miles of elevated track and fertilized and seeded the soil underneath to make it ready for agricultural use?
There's a specific answer to his argument on 8.15. He said once you determine it's feasible, you value it as if it was vacant and ready for such use.
So that is the valuation for highest and best use, and we acknowledge that the fact that this property, we agree as to the highest and best use.
You heard what he said. I mean, an ordinary listener might be sitting in the audience and say, well, that sounds pretty good, what he just said. That's why I asked him whether I have to rule the Yellow Book is unconstitutional on its face.
You don't, Your Honor, because what the Yellow Book says is, yes, property is valued taking into consideration its highest and best use. And the fact of the highest and best use, as explained in our reply brief, means that it's reasonably possible for the conversion
to
occur.
That takes into consideration the condition of the property when you're asking what its highest and best use is.
It does, but then once the highest and best use is determined, that is not the same thing as fair market value. As Judge Hughes' hypothetical alludes to, the fact that the highest and best use might be agricultural doesn't mean that you value the land as though it were completely vacant. The ultimate valuation has to take into account development costs. And the cases we cite in our opening brief about the subdivision are just an example of that. But whether it be a subdivision or any kind of...
Are you saying when he said you value it as if it's vacant and ready for such use, you would say that this property is not ready for agricultural use when it is not level and when it may have obstructions on it?
No, Your Honor. I want to be clear about this. Our position, what's valued here is not the individual corridor. It's the larger parcel that these plaintiffs have. And so what they have is mostly agricultural land that's vacant. But they also now have, in the situation in which the taking didn't occur, they would have part of the land had an abandoned rail line running through it.
So you're valuing what the farmland is worth per acre, and then you're giving them that value for however many acres or parts of that the easement occupies?
So we concede that the highest and best use of the entire parcel as a whole is agricultural. And that concession, implicit in that concession, is the idea that it would be reasonably possible for the abandoned rail line to be converted to agricultural use. But that does not mean that it wouldn't cost anything to make that conversion. And the question is, who bears the cost of converting that abandoned rail line into agricultural use? That is a completely separate question from the highest and best use. There is nothing in the Yellow Book that says that the highest and best use is always the fair market value. As this court said in the Prince William County line of cases, you need to consider the current condition of the property. Yes, it's an element of highest and best use, but independent of highest and best use, if the current condition reduces fair market value, which all the plaintiff's experts conceded, then you have to consider it as well.
The Court of Federal Claims has always interpreted the Yellow Book the way that the landowner is interpreting it here, has it not?
No, Your Honor. The Court of Federal Claims has never, in any, certainly in this context, interpreted the Yellow Book to mean that once you determine what the value of the land is, as if it were ready for the highest and best use, that that automatically is fair market value. Plaintiffs haven't cited any cases in support of that position. We've cited cases supporting the position that it's patent error, once you determine highest and best use, to disregard the development costs necessary to make that land adaptable for its highest and best use.
What do you do with a future case where the rail easement had, they'd been taking toxic chemicals across the easement and they poisoned the earth, but it's in agricultural land? Does that condition of the easement bear on the highest and best use?
It may, in a given case, it may be that the land is so contaminated that the highest and best use, in fact, would not be agricultural. We don't have that situation here.
I'm thinking about future cases. I'm thinking about others. I mean, here we have a situation where there's hardly much consequence to the harm of the land from the leftovers from the rail easement. But what happens if there's significant ones?
Well, it could come into play in two ways. One, it could come into play in the initial determination of highest and best use. If it was so extreme that the land couldn't be converted financially, it wouldn't be financially reasonable to convert it, then it might change the highest and best use, which then would impact fair market value. Or, alternatively, it could be more like this case, where it's not so significant as to impact the overall highest and best use, but it is significant in the sense that the landowner is going to have to pay to convert that land in a condition that makes it adaptable for the highest and best use. So it could be either way, but the point
here, you can have situations, for example, different from this one, like if you're going through agricultural land, but say it's in New England, which is hilly and valleys, and so there are a lot of bridges and a lot of major structure that would have to be removed in order, hypothetically, in order to farm the land.
Right. And that might, in a particular case, it might be such an... It would require
such a change.
What
you're telling me is the dollar, the cost of removing the impediment is going to tell me what the highest and best use is.
Right, because one element of highest and best use is whether it's financially feasible to achieve that use. But either way, even if it's financially feasible, the question is who bears that cost? And that's really what this comes down to in this case, is that we agree that it would be financially feasible, or at least in most cases. Our appraiser did it. Parcel by parcel analysis of would the farmer reclaim this particular land? Would it be worthwhile depending on how much it would cost? And we can argue about how much it would cost in any given case.
Right. Well, that's what Judge Firestone thought that's where the looking at the remnants, that's where it came in to say, is it so much that it would affect the highest and best use? And then she concluded that it wasn't, and she said, once I've considered it for that purpose, I don't consider it again.
Right, and the first part was right, and the second part was wrong.
Okay. All right, thank you.